Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, Wyoming is looking at the high cost of health care and insurance.
Wyoming's cost for private insurance is amongst the most expensive in the country.
Mistrust between environmental groups and local government is keeping the Yellowstone grizzly bear in limbo.
Our organization has never called for the complete annihilation of the species.
And we'll explore why Washington, D.C. lawmakers could learn from local collaborators working to solve wildlife and other controversial issues.
Because they don't spend enough time together. They're not neighbors. They're not living in the same town.
Those stories, plus reports on oil prices and the third annual conference for violence prevention and response in the state, it's all ahead on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The federal government released a sweeping report on climate change last week that predicts more wildfires and catastrophic weather across the nation unless lawmakers act. But like most Republicans, Wyoming's lawmakers don't take the document too seriously. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
According to scientists spread across 13 agencies within the federal government controlled by President Trump, the West is slated to see even more devastating wildfires in the future if nothing is done to combat climate change. Wyoming's junior senator John Barrasso says he doesn't completely discount the report, though he says Democrats' solutions to the problem would cripple the state's economy in the near term.
Take it seriously. Some of the things that are being proposed out there, though, have even a greater negative impact on our economy than what's in the report.
Barrasso is referring to the so-called Green New Deal being proposed by progressives that seeks to get America completely off of fossil fuels. While the government report, that's mandated by Congress, predicts that by the end of the century, the economy risks losing $500 billion annually unless action is taken, Barrasso says the economy will be in shambles if Democrats get their way.
And the results would be more dire if you took into account some of the things they want to do now in terms of hurting our American economy with saying, no, we're going to make energy more expensive. We're going to stop using some of the more affordable sources of energy.
That logic is lost on Western Democrats like Washington State's Maria Cantwell. She's the top Democrat on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Cantwell says Republicans like Barrasso are putting their corporate donors above sound policy.
This is a cost factor to the federal government, and they know that because they're seeing it on fire, they're seeing it on drought, they're seeing it on disaster. So the question is whether they're going to own up to the fact that they could do better things for the future.
But Barrasso also says the report is misguided because there's nothing the U.S. alone can do to prevent its dire warnings.
There is so much of a fatalism of the report when you say that, when you look at the fact that you could turn off the United States tomorrow and it wouldn't have any really long-term impact because of the fact that China and India and others, their emissions continue to go up.
That sentiment is also echoed by Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney, though she goes a step or three further. She wants to completely disband the Environmental Protection Agency and denies humans are causing the Earth's temperatures to rise. She says the report won't distract the GOP from driving their pro-coal and gas agenda in the next Congress.
The idea that you're going to, you know, continue down this path of just killing the fossil fuel industry puts it puts our economy at risk and it puts our security directly at risk, too.
Cheney is now the number three House Republican leader in Congress, and she says she's focused on combating Democrats' attempts to curb carbon pollution in the new year.
They tried to use the guise of addressing climate change to impose, you know, industry-killing regulations. And we've got to make sure that, you know, we continue to roll those back. And we're going to have to protect the gains from the Democratic majority now in the House.
Incoming Florida Democratic Congresswoman-elect Donna Shalala says Wyoming Republicans have their heads buried underground, while her constituents are at risk of losing the ground under their feet.
They're all deniers.
Yeah.
They're all deniers. There's no one in South Florida that's a denier. For us, it's life or death. Even the Republicans down there.
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi dismisses the government's report on climate change as a piece of work. but he argues having a vibrant economy enables more innovation in the clean energy sectors of tomorrow.
I'm for as clean energy as we can get. I'm a believer in innovation and think that we're doing that. And that will solve things if we get cooperation with it. And it'll keep the economy going.
While the majority of moderate Republicans who want to tackle climate change head-on were swept out of office earlier this month, a few still remain. Pennsylvania Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick supports a tax on carbon in order to combat climate change, and he sees his role in the upcoming Congress as trying to lobby his fellow Republicans from Wyoming and elsewhere to open their eyes to the threat of climate change.
It just tells me there's a lot of work to be done. You know, anybody who doesn't see the light on this yet, my job is to get them to see the light on it.
There you go,
part of
brother.
My job, not just voting, but, you know, convincing people to do the right thing.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The North American benchmark price of oil dropped this week to its lowest since 2017. It pulled down share prices of major producing companies with it, many that operate here in Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with Refinitiv market specialist Carl Leary on what the drop means and how it happened.
Well, I think, you know, the first concern of the oil price drop has definitely been the global economy. We've seen demand pull back from China. We've seen some issues in other countries, Latin America, and obviously in the U.S. You know, we've had some issues here where there's a lot of supply and demand's not really keeping up with that. So that kind of started it. And, you know, definitely what follows it up and what we're ending with here these past couple weeks is the high glut of supply. We are producing so much oil here in the U.S. right now, it's weighing on the market.
I thought that there were some international factors that weighed into this as well. Is that a part of it?
You know, it is. And as we talk about supply, that's where we see the issues with the international factors. We're seeing a lot of other countries, you know, mainly Saudi Arabia being the biggest culprit of producing higher amounts than they have in the past few years. Saudi Arabia right now is pumping well over 11 million barrels and coming close to 12 million barrels a day with not a lot of buyers on the market. So between the U.S., you know, exporting about 2.5 million barrels a day and the Saudis producing at record levels, we're seeing a lot of supply here. So, you know, it could be people are trying to be careful if there's going to be sanctions in Iran or if we're seeing some issues down in Venezuela. People want to make sure there's oil for the market. But right now, it's just too much too soon.
You mentioned sanctions on Iran that sought to tank Iran's oil exports and limit global production. What happened there?
They've been selective. So what happened because of the sanctions is that we saw an immediate shock. People were thinking, oh, bad. But then President Trump gave a little loophole here and there to several different countries. So they are still putting oil out. It's just they're not putting as much oil out. You know, there's an issue there. People are afraid we're going to run out too fast. What's really happening is that there's just not enough demand for it. Even if there wasn't Iran sanctions, we'd still have too much oil right now.
So Wyoming is one of the bigger producers of oil and gas and increasing. It's also been a key contributor to tax revenue, so it does have a top-down effect. Do you think that this price drop is going to last? And if it does, will that have any impact on oil-producing states like Wyoming?
So I think that the oil price is dropping so significantly over the last 7 weeks, we have learned a lesson, something we saw back in 2014 when oil production in the U.S. was going higher. We saw prices, you know, very high. But, you know, at that point, OPEC refused to cut back on their production. So did Russia. They kept pumping. And we saw a significant drop back in 2014 into 15 and you know, felt all the way down to 2016. So the point is, I think that this time around, OPEC, Russia, the U.S., we all know a little bit better. We're not going to see that significant drop back down from where we were to, you know, the low 30s, high 20s. I think we're going to find a stopgap here somewhere soon in the 50s. And what's important for a state like Wyoming, we need to see WTI, the U.S. benchmark, above $50. We'd like to see it above 55 to make it, you know, a little wiggle room. And we definitely would like to see it above 60 to keep things going forward. So right now it's a precocious time, but I think all parties involved are a little bit smarter and we have a lot of potential to go back up into the next few months.
So companies' share prices that operate here, some of the publicly traded oil companies like Anadarko, EOG, they've seen a little bit of stock hits. How long would it have to be of depressed prices for there to actually be a change in management plan or a change in production plan?
Well, you know, the way oil companies usually work, especially here in the U.S., is when they become sensitive to prices, they need to see that extend past 3 months. 3 months is that key level, the key area where oil companies realize, okay, we need to start pulling back. We need to start pulling back, you know, make plans to kind of halt the production. So I think right now, like we mentioned at the start, we're about 7 weeks in. So, you know, we've got probably another 5 or 6 here before somebody really starts to say, we have to stop now. We can't keep going like this if these prices stay so depressed or have the risk of going lower. So it's, it's getting to that point, but I think that there's a lot of potential here for the new year to kind of turn this around right now.
So 2019, you see as a potential moment to bounce back?
I do. We just need OPEC and Russia to kind of pull back a little bit, just enough, so we can see some firmness in oil prices, and we can see that rebound kind of continue all the way through the first half of next year.
If oil prices were high, gas prices would be high pretty equivalently?
You know, we've managed to balance it out. So even if prices do go back up, I don't think we're going to see that rubber band snap where prices are going to shoot back up and we'll see high gasoline prices. It'll be moderate, but you know, we have to take the good with the bad sometimes, and growth isn't so bad.
Great. Well, thanks for joining me, Carl. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Cooper.
That was our energy reporter, Cooper McKim, speaking with Carl Leary, an oil and gas advisor. Analysts say EOG Resources will be able to operate comfortably at $40, with current barrel prices going back and forth between $50 and $51.
When we return, we'll hear about a new experiment here at Wyoming Public Radio, a pop-up newsroom. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. This week, Wyoming Public Radio engaged in a bit of an experiment. Our reporters, Tennessee Watson and Melody Edwards, set up a pop-up newsroom at the 3rd Annual Wyoming Conference for Violence Prevention and Response, hosted in Riverton. With me from their temporary studio in the pop-up newsroom are Tennessee and Melody. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So tell me what this idea of a pop-up newsroom is all about.
So the Wyoming Conference for Violence Prevention and Response drew together people from across the state, from public health to education to victim advocates to activists that are building a movement to end violence in our state. And rarely as reporters do we have the chance to connect with all these folks at the same time, especially in a big state like Wyoming. I was thinking, like, I would be driving so much to actually be able to meet with these people face to face. And rarely do we see them all working together to solve a common problem. So we just thought this would be an amazing opportunity to hear what's happening. And so we set up a space where folks could share what they're seeing on the ground and relay to us what's working to help fix some of these problems.
Yeah, and you know, we also know that stories about violence are often really deeply personal and can be really painful. And we knew that showing up and making personal connections was going to be really important. You know, sexual violence and domestic abuse, too often they do stay secret. And we might tell a friend, or we might tell a family member, we might tell a counselor. But, you know, national statistics indicate that 2 out of 3 sexual assaults go unreported to law enforcement. And, you know, that's even more on the reservation. Advocates know that crime statistics go grossly underrepresented, and the prevalence of sexual violence and domestic abuse, too. So nor do they tell the story, you know, of how interpersonal violence can harm entire communities and future generations.
And, you know, on that front, what Melody was saying does remind me of the Me Too movement and how powerful it's been to hear these personal stories that kind of bring life to statistics and get at issues in a deeper way. But Me Too, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that public disclosure is safe for everyone in every community. And it's apparent, especially after being at this conference, that journalists need to pay attention to some of those factors, be they political, cultural, or emotional, and, you know, these things that can put survivors at risk. And so while we need to be tireless advocates for the power of personal stories, we need to be willing to understand how to reduce harm. So that's the other reason that being here, this is people who are on the ground working with survivors of violence on a daily basis. And we really wanted to understand from them how we can approach our work in a way that has the highest impact, but that does the least amount of harm.
And so, you know, to kick things off, what we did is we just invited some of the sources from our stories, our stories that we have done in the past, and just asked them to share their perspectives on what it was like to work with journalists.
Who were they, and why did you invite them?
So I ended up inviting Jean Harris. She's an Eastern Shoshone member who spoke to me about her experience of domestic abuse and the really hard time that she ended up having getting justice on the Wind River Reservation. And that's because there's just a major jurisdictional gaps for tribal members. And she told the audience to, you know, on Wednesday, what it was like to participate in a radio story. And this one ended up actually on National Public Radio as well. And she just talked about, you know, how that ended up helping her to keep her case moving through the system, but that also it was, you know, going public with her case was also really hard as well. She ended up receiving death threats even. And so we used that story throughout the conference to really teach people about how journalism works.
And I invited Bishop Stephen Bigler. He is the bishop for the Diocese of Cheyenne. And I had interviewed him for a story that was on Wyoming Public Radio, but that also got national attention and was on NPR. But it was, you know, looking at what the church in Wyoming is doing about allegations of sexual violence perpetrated by clergy members. And, you know, what happened here stands out because the bishop in this case, really, he took a stance saying we need to listen to survivors. And the thing about that story that I wanted to point out to people in the room at this conference is that it's not that Bishop Stephen is a hero. You know, it's not a hero of the day kind of story. It's that he has accessed certain resources. He has been trained and he's sensitive to these issues. And then he's deployed that in his work. So he's really, you know, worked hard to wrap his head around what it means to be in a position of power and authority and to leverage that to make sure that victims and survivors are coming forward. And that's important for victims and survivors, but it's also important for safety within communities. He wants people within his community to feel comfortable coming forward because then it means that perpetrators within that community are being held accountable and they can't do it again.
And so you had this room where people could walk in and basically talk to you at any time?
Yeah, so the conference was actually at the Wind River Casino and Hotel that's owned by the Northern Arapaho Tribe, and I promise we were not gambling the whole time. There's also actually a really great conference center here, and so we got our own room, and folks just filtered through, you know, during their breaks and over lunch. But we also ended up in a conversation in the hotel stairway one evening. People just got really comfortable just sharing their ideas. And, you know, the pop-up newsroom concept really ended up breaking down barriers between us, the media, and all of these change makers that were at this conference.
And it was pretty telling, you know, what we heard. So we got feedback on story ideas. We got feedback on how we could tell our stories. But it was also interesting to just observe who and came to talk to us. We learned from that. So that we had a prosecutor come and talk to us. And he, in fact, was the only one, the only prosecutor at this event. And we got to hear his point of view on the criminal justice system and, you know, how it responds to violence and is a part of preventing violence. But it was surprising that there weren't more prosecutors there. So it was interesting just to get to see who was in the room.
Yeah, like we also ended up talking to a lot of people who work at safe houses for survivors of domestic violence. You know, safe houses all across the state. And we heard that the lack of affordable housing across the state is making it really hard for women to get out of, you know, these really abusive situations.
We also heard about a need for more prevention education with young people, focusing on violence and in particular sex education and how those two things go together. And we heard that there is some great programming on the Wind River Reservation that other communities could look to. And it was just great to be like, oh, here's a problem. Oh, here's a solution, and connect some of those dots for people in the room, but also for our stories. And that is really, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Just this morning, we had the entire conference sit down with 11 different story ideas and help us fine tune them. We, you know, got them to drill down to what the problem was and asked them to help us identify who in the state was working to solve it. So we've got some great stories to tell about ways to solve these issues.
Yeah, tell me more about what happens now.
Well, now we get to work telling these stories. And we literally just wrapped up that session, so our brains are full to the brim. One example of something that we might look at was we heard about a lot of great projects that are happening in isolation. But, you know, one of those things is dealing with addiction. So the Department of Corrections has some strong programming to address addiction. And there are also communities with great resources. But it's sort of luck of the draw. Like if you're released from jail, there's no guarantee that you're going to end up in a town that is well-resourced to help you transition. So there was a lot of talk about addressing those disparities and making sure that everyone working to alleviate addiction was in communication with each other. So now the work is on us to find one of those unique partnerships that's really helping to provide continuity in services. And it was just interesting to see how that issue came up. And then they were like, all right, do your homework, reporters, figure this out.
Do you feel like this was a successful experiment?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Everyone was extremely open, really excited to share. It felt like it really filled a need to sort of break down that fourth wall between journalists and the people in Wyoming who are making change. And we learned people were hesitant to call us because they felt like they didn't know enough. And we were able to make it clear that everyone is a source or of a, sort of like a piece of the puzzle, and that we talk to lots of people to figure out what's going on, and we never rely on the knowledge of just one person to tell a story. So, you know, it was a real opportunity to sort of give people just a little journalism 101, you know, and just share the terms, you know, and reveal a little bit about the process of making a good journalism story.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, we're excited to get back on the road and get back to Laramie. There is some impending snow, so that's one reason we want to get out of here. But the other reason is we're just really excited to get back to work so we can tell these stories.
All right. Well, be safe on your way back, and thanks so much for sharing.
Thanks, Caroline.
Thanks.
That was Tennessee Watson and Melody Edwards at our pop-up newsroom in Riverton at the third annual Wyoming Conference for Violence Prevention and Response.
Coming up, we'll have stories about healthcare costs in the state and the business of private firefighters. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. A Wyoming legislative committee has quietly put together a series of bills that's looking at the high cost of healthcare in the state, as well as making healthcare more accessible. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
At a recent meeting of the legislature's Health and Labor Committee, Senator Charles Scott stated that consumers pay a lot for health care in the state.
Wyoming's cost for private insurance is amongst the most expensive in the country. And the discussion earlier this morning was that we were second in insurance costs on the exchange. That's not a position we need to be in.
Some say the reason Wyoming insurance costs are high is because the state has an older population, and older people have more health needs. Another dilemma is that Wyoming's small population means the sicker people can drive up costs for everyone. Senator Fred Baldwin of Kemmerer says the problem needs to be fixed.
you know, everybody acknowledges that with the increases in insurance costs, the increase in premiums, we have to do something because we push so many people out of being able to even have insurance.
The committee approved a bill that would give the Department of Insurance the ability to develop a plan where they would use state and federal money to help pay for the insurance of people who have more expensive health care needs. They believe that would reduce the premiums for the state's healthy population. But the other part of the problem is that health care costs in Wyoming are high, especially when it comes to hospital care. Here's Senator Scott.
We were eighth in the nation on hospital costs, and they're 48% of the total health care costs that Wyoming residents incur.
Scott says the national average is around 38%. To address the situation, the committee has crafted a comprehensive bill that will take a deep dive into healthcare costs, especially in hospitals.
And we're trying to understand that and understand it with data, because otherwise it's just competing anecdotes and you can't sort them out. Try to figure out what's wrong and what can we do about it. It's a practical matter.
Eric Boley heads up the Wyoming Hospital Association. He says he welcomes the study, but says costs of care are not out of line.
I have facilities that are operating negative margins. The only way that they stay in existence is because of the tax revenues that come in. We're not flush with money.
Boley points out that other states in the region expanded Medicaid, and he suggests that's why they're doing much better financially. He says that needs to be part of the study.
If we're going to take a look at the cost of health care, cost shifting, and all those things, expansion should be included in this to see what impact it would have had.
The committee agreed and added it in. Jackson Representative Mike Giroux thinks support for expansion is growing in the state and is pleased that they're looking at it. He says they need some facts.
Here are all these numbers get thrown around. We left $500 million on the table, or there's so many people that are going to game the system. Well, let's find out. Let's take a comprehensive look at what it would be in Wyoming.
One other issue the committee wants to look at is why 24% of Wyoming residents get their health care needs out of state. Eric Boley of the Hospital Association says insurance companies have pushed some patients out of Wyoming when it isn't necessary.
If we continue to direct some of this care out of the state, all we're doing is we're driving costs up for those that need it in a critical situation.
The committee is also looking at ways to make healthcare more accessible via such things as telehealth. Representative Giroux says they are doing all they can to finally get a handle on the insurance and overall costs that are hurting the state. The full legislature will consider the legislation in January. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Wyomingites working to reduce violence gathered this week for the third annual Conference for Violence Prevention and Response. A major portion of the conference was devoted to spreading awareness about the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACEs for short. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson sat down with Jennifer Davis from the Wyoming Children's Trust Fund and Todd Garrison from the Montana-based not-for-profit ChildWise to understand why the ACEs study could make a difference in Wyoming.
I think that people 50 years from now will look back and say this was a milestone in our history as a human race, because the science from this study points to childhood adversity that all of us on some level can relate to, whether it was personally for us or someone close to us. So it's a very personal thing, and that's why it has such power that it does. And that's why it'll be so significant.
All right, what is an adverse childhood experience and what does it mean for people?
So adverse childhood experiences, the study looked at a questionnaire that is derived with 10 questions that's broken down into three categories. There is a category for abuse, which looks at physical abuse, emotional abuse, and sexual abuse. Then it is broken down into the second category, which is neglect, which looks at physical neglect and emotional neglect. And the third category is called household dysfunction. And that looks at, was there domestic violence in the home growing up? Was there a caregiver for that child that used substances? Was there a caregiver that had a mental health issue? Was there a parent in the home that was incarcerated during the childhood? And was there domestic violence in the home growing up? So those are the 10 questions that individuals are asked to answer over the age of 18. And for each question that you answer yes, it gives you 1 point. And then we look at a total score from that. And what we find with the adverse childhood experiences are two things. They're very common. Lots of people will have at least one, and that the other thing that we find is that they're highly interrelated, meaning that if you have one, there's a very high probability that you will have another ACE as well.
And so why is it important to pay attention to adverse childhood experiences?
I think the importance of this research is that if you look at, I believe, every health and social ill in our nation, you can connect the dots to the ACE study. Because of the results of the ACE study, which point to the more ACEs you have, the more risk factors you have for many health and social problems. That's why I say it's so important, because almost all health and social problems we have in our country are related to early childhood adversity. And the adversity experience can actually change, alter brain development and brain architecture. It's not just an emotional thing, it's a physiological biology.
So is there something that folks would, you know, recognize as a common public health issue prevalent among adults that you connect back to ACEs?
The study, through the research that they did initially, was able to connect the dots back to many health-related issues such as diabetes, coronary heart disease, obesity. So we know that there is a correlation. Your risk factors for those diseases increase as the amount of adversity increases.
And so it sounds like there's sort of this call to action, like we can prevent things down the line happening to adults if we pay attention to what's happening to kids.
Yes. This gives us the motivation to stop ACEs from happening. You can't reverse ACEs that have already happened, but you can stop future ACEs happening. And I think that starts with knowledge and education of the study with parents, in families, on reservations, in law enforcement, across the board, because this is so personal and applies to so many things. So let's take suicide, for example. Suicide in our nation is very high. In Montana, where I live, we are number one in the nation for teenage suicide, 15 to 17 years old. And I think Wyoming has high numbers of suicide youth as well. So just imagine if we could stop ACEs from happening. A generation from now, no more ACEs were happening. Imagine the impact we could have on youths feeling like they have to take their own life.
It's so interesting, though, that something that involves so much neuroscience and the medical field ultimately comes back to that idea of asking us to slow down and just take care of each other.
It's about relationships. That's really the core thing. We were built for relationship in our brains, and the brain science tells us that as well. We are created to have a relationship. We're created in a relationship, and we are made for relationships. And when relationships breaks down, this is what happens, is adversity happens. What's broken by relationship needs to be repaired by relationship.
And so Todd's talking about what's happening in Montana. I get the sense that he's been invited to this conference because he sort of has some wisdom to share with people in Wyoming. And I'm wondering, Jen, can you tell us where this is at in Wyoming?
We currently, since September of last year, have trained over 2,000 people here in Wyoming through education, through public health, through just community meetings. And so our goal is to get that information far and wide. So again, what Todd said, it really is about building relationships. And I think we do have a unique possibility in Wyoming to leverage that for the good.
Well, good luck with your work, and thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you, Tennessee.
It has been a brutal fire season this year. The The fires still burning across California have left more than 80 dead and nearly 200 people are still missing. Amidst the flames, a seemingly new trend has emerged, a two-tiered system with private firefighting resources for those who can afford them and a system stretched thin for the rest. Nick Mott spoke with a couple of private outfits centered in our region.
I'm walking through a mixture of hail and snow into a barn outside of Missoula.
The sign says, Stallion, do not enter. Is there danger in there?
Well, I decided to leave those up. I used to run up to 15 stallions a season in here.
Troy Kurth heads up the private firefighting company Rocky Mountain Fire. He's showing me around where his crews prep for their 14-day assignments.
We got out of the horse business. You run a stallion station here, and so we converted this horse barn into our fire cache and shop.
And he says those firefighting services are increasingly in demand.
Victims in the state's worst ever wildfire.
On this day, Kurth has four of his engines and about eight personnel on the ground in California.
Officials say the death toll is now up to at least 85 people.
It's all part of a new spin on a recent trend. Starting in the 1980s, the Forest Service began facing tighter budgets and more destructive fires. So it started contracting with private firefighting companies to help out. Then, more recently, the private insurance industry got involved and started offering private firefighting services on its home policies. David Torgerson is president of Bozeman-based Wildfire Defense Systems, the largest private firefighting group in the country.
This contribution from the insurance industry is here to stay. It's become the new norm.
Like other private companies, Torgerson continues to contract with state and federal government, but now he's also working with about a dozen private insurers. Since 2008, he says his crews have responded to more than 550 wildfires that included thousands of private properties. He adds most of the homes have been average value, not million-dollar mansions. And either way, he says the more resources for these raging fires, the better.
Quietly in the background, these insurer programs have been growing and contributing in a strong way and creating, you know, better results to the extent possible and contributing to these incidents. It's really a win-win.
But how easy is it to get that coverage for the average homeowner? That's not clear.
Some of the most beautiful places to live are prone to natural disasters.
Here's an ad from insurance giant AIG.
The Wildfire Protection Unit. This complimentary service helps our customers prepare their homes.
AIG did not respond to email interview requests, but according to its website, the complimentary service is available only to its private client group, which is custom designed for high-end properties. Eric Szymanski is with Chubb, another insurance provider that offers this service to all clients in fire-prone areas across 18 states.
It's complimentary. So if you're a policyholder within those states, it's part of your homeowner's policy.
But there may be another problem with any kind of insurance in some of those areas.
The affordability issue is one that is growing here in California. We're continuing to see prices increase.
That's Nancy Kincaid, a spokesperson for the California Department of Insurance. Her state has more homes in fire-prone areas than any other region. And she says homeowners there are having more and more trouble securing coverage of any kind due to increasing premiums. Carl Seilstad has been studying fire trends for decades as an associate professor of fire science and management at the University of Montana and a practicing fire incident commander. He says this trend towards private firefighting is a reflection of our society.
I mean, that's capitalism, right? That if you have assets to be protected and you can pay for protection, that you would pay extra for the protection that you get.
Whether it's fair and equitable is more complicated, he says. For one, nobody's keeping track of the industry and who's using the services. However,
even the perception that fire management plays favorites, whether it's fair or not, erodes confidence in the fire management enterprise.
And he's not just worried about the insurance industry protecting individual properties. It's also the private money flowing into state and federal fire suppression.
When does private enterprise start dictating how fire management gets done?
Fire and forest management is already an ecological and political issue. So what happens, he says, when profit comes into play too? The private firefighter industry continues to grow. According to the industry's trade group, there are more than 150 companies employing more than 12,000 crew members. I'm Nick Mott for the Mountain West News Bureau.
Ahead, we'll end the program with stories about how different groups want controversial wildlife managed, like grizzly bears and prairie dogs. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The conflict whether Yellowstone grizzly bears should be off or on Endangered Species Act protections has been an ongoing controversy for years. Even after a judge put grizzlies back under federal protections this fall, the debate continues. As Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska finds out, those in favor of the judge's decision and those against are suspicious of each other's motives.
In the most recent fight, the possibility of the first grizzly hunting season in over 40 years in Wyoming and Idaho became the focal point for a number of environmental groups who said that a move for an immediate hunt proves the state and federal government doesn't want to protect the bears, but wipe them out as quickly as possible. Sierra Club's Connie Wilbert says that would be devastating to the ecosystem.
When we protect those big, highly visible species, we are protecting everything else under it.
Andrea Santasiri with the Center for Biological Diversity agrees. She says grizzlies are one of the slowest reproducing mammals, and it takes a female bear 10 years to be replaced.
When you're looking at the intentional killing of over a dozen female bears, that's why we feel like there could be catastrophic implications that could really dramatically impact the grizzly bear population.
The Game and Fish Department has acknowledged that killing females is a concern, and they are trying to address that issue with the hunting regulations. Capitalized hunters like Bob Worf, who is the president of Wyoming Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, says they are sensitive to harming the species.
Our organization has never called for the complete annihilation of the species. We've always said it needs to be managed. We're all about managing for sustainability, because we want it to be here for future generations.
In other words, Worf says hunters will protect the bears.
The people that don't hunt, I don't think they get that. To me, the safest species are the ones we hunt. The ones that we don't hunt are the ones, in my mind, they're more susceptible to face problems.
Worf says the point is grizzly numbers are getting too big and management is needed because it's getting dangerous.
We've had at least one death that I'm aware of. We've had several maulings. All of those things, to me, factor into perhaps a delisting.
Brian Nesvik, the chief game warden of Wyoming Game and Fish, says the state knows best how to handle conflicts. It's normal to deal with 5 to 6 conflicts at the same time.
It's not out of the norm. Our folks are very experienced and have learned what works best and is most efficient.
They handle conflicts on a case-by-case basis, and that doesn't always involve killing the bear. Many times it's relocation. Both sides also accuse the other of trying to make money off of the grizzlies through various fundraising mechanisms or even license fees. Molly Marsh Haney with Earth Justice says it helps, but it certainly doesn't generate big bucks. She says the grizzly is similar to other species that are well known,
like wolverines or the manatee, you know, other really threatened species. That tends to garner a certain type of supporter that is very wildlife focused.
The day the grizzly delisting case was heard in court, Earth Justice sent out an email appeal to supporters to help protect grizzly bears. The appeal itself generated $47,000. The group's revenue is about $7 million. Grizzly bears helped fundraise 0.06%. And by the way, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department would only make $56,000 at most from grizzly licenses, which is just 0.07% of its budget. It ultimately comes down to a trust and philosophical issue over how grizzlies should be managed. Both sides claim they want the grizzly bear to be recovered, but neither trusts the other side's approach. Sportsmen and women and the state are concerned about human and health issues, but environmental groups are more concerned about the bear. Where this ends up is anybody's guess. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
For years, Wyoming and other Western states have successfully solved controversial problems related to wildlife and forests by getting people on all sides of an issue to come together to hash out solutions. Now, a new stakeholder group is tackling the age-old controversy over prairie dogs. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports for our series, I Respectfully Disagree, with a national political scene in gridlock, these local groups are struggling.
The sun is coming up lavender and peach as we drive out onto Wyoming's eastern plains. Defenders of Wildlife's Shammy Anderson is taking me out in search of prairie dogs.
Look at this, isn't this beautiful? Are we entering in here?
We are entering.
Oh yeah, here's a sign.
It says we're entering into the Thunder Basin National Grasslands, nearly 550,000 acres of little-known public lands. Back in 2012, Anderson helped set aside 18,000 acres of this prairie to establish a protected population of prairie dogs. Anderson says they're what's called a keystone species.
Their burrows provide homes for swift fox, for mountain plover, burrowing owls. Without the prairie dog, then we start to see a lot of other native wildlife species go downhill.
Like the black-footed ferret, one of the most endangered animals in North America. Their main food is prairie dogs, and Anderson says Thunder Basin is one of the last large swaths of habitat for them anywhere. But when we get to the prairie dog's protected area, all the burrows are empty.
Yeah, normally you'd hear lots of chirps out here, and you'd also hear hawks above. And it's unusually quiet out here. Like, very.
Last year, a plague wiped out all the prairie dogs in this area. And Anderson says her group didn't agree with local ranchers about how to manage the disease. That's when yet another collaborative in a long string of them was assembled to figure out how to manage prairie dogs on this landscape. Ty Checkitz was one of those ranchers. When the prairie dog population exploded, he couldn't keep them inside their boundary, and they encroached onto the land he leases from the Forest Service.
Ty Checkitz doesn't get scared much, but I was scared. I was scared that I'd have enough feed to feed my cows, and I was scared I'd make enough money to pay my bills.
Prairie dogs ate all his grass before his cows could. He says attending these meetings is costly for him, but he is committed.
I think it's really a blessing to live in a country that we can sit down and look at somebody eye to eye that we disagree with and try to work out a solution. I mean, that's really our government at work. We're not a dictatorship.
But to these people, the way the meetings were handled last time kind of felt like a dictatorship. The Forest Service had a rule that only government reps could speak at them, not landowners, not wildlife groups. Now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is in charge, and they don't have that rule. Department of Ag's Chris Wickman says so far this new effort has been pretty productive.
We've already, through four meetings now, have agreed to several things. Everybody, not just one side, landowners or the other.
Wickman says wildlife groups brought one of the ideas to the table. They proposed moving the prairie dog protection zone so natural barriers like mountains and rivers can control their spread, instead of paying people to manage man-made barriers.
But for them to show that on their own, with their own maps, to that group shows that this collaborative here is working, because it shows that they're engaged.
Defenders of Wildlife Shammy Anderson says she's hopeful this collaborative will succeed. But she says there could be more support from the state's congressional delegation.
We know the ranchers are getting the ear of our delegation, particularly Representative Liz Cheney, and so we've also been attempting to have similar meetings with her, although I've only been able to meet with her staffers.
Collaboration, which means to co-labor, to work together, it is so incredibly dependent on building relationships.
Jessica Western trains people to do just that. She's the director of the Collaboration Program in Natural Resources at the University of Wyoming's Ruckelshaus Institute, and worked on the last prairie dog collaboration. She says there's a reason for the lack of compromise by lawmakers in Washington, D.C.
Because they don't spend enough time together. Their kids don't go to the same schools. They're not neighbors. They're not living in the same town.
She's encouraged that Thunder Basin ranchers are inviting wildlife activists out for campouts and barbecues. She says it would help if more lawmakers got involved in collaborations in their districts and support them in other ways, too.
Something, for example, that they have in Colorado that I would dearly love to see in Wyoming is a pool of money from the state that enables people to engage in collaborative process, because it takes time. It takes money.
The Forest Service has given the Prairie Dog Collaborative until the end of the year to come up with its recommendations. The group only has one more meeting before then. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire program or individual segments, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
We can't make this show or any of our great news programming without financial support from our listeners. If you'd like to make a year-end donation, you can visit us at that website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
And you can also sign up for our podcast on that site. A reminder that we're always happy to hear your story ideas. Just drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.